WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, January 15th. Yesterday, the Biden administration, which is in its last week, lifted the U.S. designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism. With that, Biden takes a similar last-minute action as Trump did in the last week of his first term in the White House. It was on January 11, 2021, that Trump added Cuba to that list. Biden did not remove Cuba from the list after he assumed the presidency, even though U.S. lawmakers repeatedly urged him to do so. In a letter to Biden in January last year, seven Massachusetts congresspeople called the terror designation by Trump a politically motivated and vindictive action. They also argued that Cuba and the United States have a functioning bilateral cooperation agreement on counterterrorism. The designation disrupted most of Cuba's international financial transactions, not just those with the United States. The disruptions affect individuals and privately owned businesses more than the Cuban government. U.S. opponents of the terror designation argue it prompts more undocumented migration from Cuba. The day after Florida Senate leader Ben Alberton and House Speaker Daniel Perez refused to cooperate with Governor Ron DeSantis on a special legislative session on immigration, Donald Trump threw his support behind DeSantis. On his Truth Social platform, Trump wrote yesterday morning, quote, "Thank you, Ron. Hopefully other governors will follow." The two Republican lawmakers, while praising Trump's immigration policies, argued it was irresponsible to dash ahead of Trump and federal policymaking. Speaking of Daniel Perez, the Florida House Speaker yesterday endorsed Sarasota State Senator Joe Gruters for chief financial officer. Gruters has a history of tensions with DeSantis. The job includes oversight of the Office of Insurance Regulation, giving the position a prominent role in managing the reprivatization of Florida's property insurance market. While being a state senator 2 years ago, Gruters raised eyebrows when he co-founded a private property insurance company and pitched his fellow lawmakers to invest in it. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, January 15th. While I have your ear, please participate in WSLR's listener survey. You will find it on WSLR.org. It'll pop up right when you open the webpage.
Good morning. This is the Peace and Justice Report. My name is Bob Connors, and you're listening to your own community radio station, WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, WBPV, LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest, and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. So I have a special guest in the studio, but before we get to her, I'd like to mention, I'm sure you might know, that it's Martin Luther King's birthday. I know they celebrated on a Monday, and so the U.S. can have a three-day weekend, but his birthday is today, and I am so proud to say that it's my birthday today. If I had to pick anyone to have a same birthday as me, it would be Martin Luther King. And in honor of Martin Luther King's birthday, I'm going to play a U2 song that references Martin Luther King's assassination and One Man in the Name of Love. So it's Pride in the Name of Love, and this is U2.
Thank you. come here to justify one man to overthrow.
Luther King, you too. And let me read a little bit about my special guest in the studio this morning. Her name is Bethany Ritz. She's a writer and editor with a background in ecological and cultural storytelling. Inspired by the more-than-human world, resilience and the hyper-local have become a cornerstone of her thinking and aspirations. She was the managing editor of Sarasota Magazine, a co-founding editor of Emergence Magazine, a digital editor for Global Oneness Project, and a board member at BOM Magazine. After studying creative writing at Columbia University, she organized and managed the launching projects for Climate Resolve, communicating climate science across Los Angeles County, designed a storytelling template for tree people in and much more. Currently, she is a public relations manager at the Ringling Museum. So, Bethany, that's an impressive bio you have there. You've done quite a bit, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about it. But the major reason you happen to be on the show today is that you have a new show that's coming on to our own community radio station the first Sunday of February. So why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit more about yourself, how you happened to come in touch with WSLR, and why you wanted to have this new Sunday morning show.
Well, WSLR has been in my sort of periphery for a long time. I've met Jesse before. I've been on the show with Juan Montenegro and his show, Latin Explosion. And yes, I am just a fan of what WSLR is doing, and I love this hyper-local conversations and community. The more I've learned about these large global crises that we find ourselves in, the more I understand that we are, as smaller communities, that's where the rubber meets the road, so to say.
Well, and, I'm glad you became a listener and a supporter of WSLR. I mean, a lot of people have not even heard of WSLR, so it's who've been in the community for 20 years or more. So why don't you tell us just a little bit more, because I want to check on something. I think we could be having a tech problem, but you go talk and tell us a little bit more about the show, and go ahead, Bethany.
So the show is called The Best of Us, Being Human in Sarasota. It's going to be a public affairs radio show on WSLR, and the show is going to explore surprising stories and in-depth conversations of strength and resilience in Sarasota and beyond. I'm very excited about the guests that we have coming on. It'll begin on February 2nd at 10 a.m. That's a Sunday. And we will proceed at this as a monthly show with the first Sunday of the month. And the show, I really wanted to create the show that would show, that would display this approach to trauma-informed culture that I'm seeing here in Sarasota. And I think there is an approach here that's pretty unique. I've lived in a lot of different places, and so when I came to Sarasota, I was really amazed by certain things. One of those things was just, obviously there's a big volunteer community here, but one of the main things that's amazing here is if you want to meet people, you volunteer, you join a nonprofit organization, or you join a group of people who are interested in supporting the community in some way. And that to me was extremely surprising. And I've met a few people along the way who just have kind of blown me away. Peace and Justice Report is one of the shows here that I think is helping to lean into this culture. And that's what my interest is in, is kind of these individual stories and how those individual stories are exemplify a way of living, a practice of living that then leans in and starts to multiply into a culture that we're living in. What are these normative practices that we do all the time? We were talking the other day, you could even bring it down to the level of how we drive on the road and these small little changes that it means teamwork. We're on the road doing teamwork, and we tend to see the road as scary and or threatening, or we're in competition with other drivers. But in fact, on the road, the majority of what we're doing is teamwork. We are working together to get somewhere safely. And as you and I talked about, those roundabouts, this small little change, actually a big change on the road, is a public space that we share, and we're not, you know, kind of facing off. And I just wanted to look at little things like that. That's not necessarily road work, but has to do with some things that people are showcasing. One of them is going to be, you know, our first show is going to be with a conservator at the Ringling who has just so impressed me with some of her personal story. And this is going to really, this first show is going to exemplify how a personal story, someone who has utilized the practice that of their daily work as a conservator, as repairing things, how's that translated into their personal life? And then we'll go into a larger story or a larger context of how arts practices or an attention on the arts actually enables a community at large to be able to develop greater resilience. You know, even the practices we have And certainly have had a lot of practice in resilience recently with the hurricanes. And we're seeing how right now with fires, how Los Angeles is starting to learn that same practice and ignite this culture of neighborliness. Here in Sarasota, we have a sense of that. And I find that really, really fascinating. You know, one of the first times that I started thinking about what we do as a community, not just in Sarasota, but how human beings kind of create these this culture. I'm really fascinated by that. Like, how does a culture develop in a place? How does that come from what we do individually on a day-to-day basis? What initiates that? One of the places in the world that has inspired me the most, I've never been there, but I heard about it on a radio show, about a place called Giel in Belgium. And what happens there is, I think it's been about 700 years that was a saint there who was said to help people with mental illness. So more than 700 years ago, people with mental illness would come to this town. And now what you see from this, what happened was people would start boarding people who were coming in town. And if you do readings on that, any kind of archival reading on and quotes, and anyone who's written about that over the last few hundred years, you see people going there amazed that how people live in harmony together in this space, and how even now it is a kind of hallmark for what's possible in living in community with people who have difference. There's one really beautiful story that stood out to me. A woman, a psychologist, went to go visit Giel, and she was staying with someone or interviewing someone who had a boarder who was someone who was neurodivergent or mentally ill, as you would say. I don't know really what the proper term is, but certainly atypical neurology. They would each day pull the buttons off of the front of he would pull the buttons off the front of his shirt, and his host, who he was living with, would sew the buttons back on in the evening. And the psychologist who was visiting said, you know, if you were to tie fishing wire through that, I don't think he'd be able to pull those buttons off anymore. And the woman looked at the psychologist and said, but he needs to pull the buttons off of the shirt. He needs to do that every day. And I found that is exactly what we mean when, you know, when we talk about what trauma-informed is. That's my understanding of trauma-informed, is not approaching someone with what is wrong with you or trying to fix a problem, but actually say, well, where does that come from? What happened to you? Or why do you do it that way? It's a profound act of listening. And Emily on the first show, she kind of shows a profound act of listening even within herself. And I'm really excited about her story. But I'm excited about every guest. So some of the list of what you can expect on the show, some of the topics I wanted to run through different sectors of how we can look at this and how it's showing up here in Sarasota. So the first one is going to be on arts and arts practice. The next one is going to be, and the main question that show is looking at is, what can the arts and conservation practices teach us about resilience? And developing a resilient culture. I also want to go into a show that talks about brilliance and how brilliance and high levels of intelligence can actually, the studies show that that's actually there's greater vulnerability within our most brilliant minds that we have, and the care that's required, and the taboos around having a mental health issue, breaking that down. You know, if we think about trauma-informed, we're not just talking about being trauma-informed with someone who is very extremely different than you or extremely maybe occurs as other to you, but we're talking about the fact that trauma is maybe an underused word. We all have things that happen to us, and ways in which we need to try to survive in certain ways. And we've developed all of these maybe idiosyncratic ways of surviving in the world that isn't always so helpful to our neighbor.
So we're all suffering from, we're not all suffering from trauma, but, you know, one aspect of our personality or one idiosyncrasy we might have, or they related to trauma, the something that happened to you when you were young. I mean, I was voted the quietest boy in the senior class, you know, in high school. And people see me now and say, no. And I say, yes, you know, my self-esteem was low, my no confidence, I didn't like school, I was anxiety-ridden, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I don't remember anything when I was young. I remember some things stand out, but I have a friend, he remembers every interaction he has with his siblings, when his what his father and mother had to say to his brother about something that happened. He goes back in time, and it amazes me. And I ask myself, why can't I do that? Because I was so anxiety ridden. I was just trying to make it through each minute. You know, let alone be aware of everything that was going on around me.
Yeah. Yeah, I relate to that. I absolutely relate to that. I'm very similar. My sister has a brilliant capacity for recall. She remembers names and faces in a way that I don't. And I also had a lot of anxiety when I was young. I think that's the interesting thing, is that one question I would have for you is, what changed?
What changed? Well, I'm going to say this on the air, really. I'm going to say it on the air. Okay. I didn't have a drink of alcohol through college, and I was looking for a job, and it took me a while. I got a temporary office specialist job, and I met who became my best friend. And fortunately for me, he was into music and drugs, and, you know, he kind of opened up my horizon, so to speak, you know. And I say, geez, I think I did drink before I saw him, because I wound up getting joining the Army Reserve when I was a senior in college, you know, and that way I did not have to go to Vietnam. And I guess I started drinking beer when I was in the Army, but as far as any drugs go, no way. So some of the experience I had, like on magic mushrooms, you know, I just saw life differently, from a different lens. Mm. And I realized that, and then I smoked marijuana for the first time, and I really got into music. And what I realized was, I can be this way without drugs. And that's more or less how I changed, you know. And then I got a job as a social worker, and I had to interview young mothers with, you know, who were on, you know, aid to families with dependent children. So I had to be, so I, all this transpired about the same time. So I had to speak to people, and I had to, so that's where it all changed for me, you know. And
that's,
I said,
so that, fascinating.
That's where it changed.
I think this, what you're highlighting here is really interesting to me, because I think a lot of people find themselves, like, to push themselves out of themselves, you know, if they're introverted or what have you, it's really, you know, they want to take the bull by the horns and, like, just be this individualistic thing. But what you're telling me is that it really is like other people who help us become who we are. And I think I've found that to be true for myself as well. And one of the things, I had my own experience with PTSD. My nervous system was completely a wreck with that. And I knew that I had to build resilience in. It wasn't just going to be about me fixing it on my own. I had to develop community and be open to community in a way that I hadn't been before. So it's really interesting to hear you say that, because that is a point or a practice of resilience, is being with other people.
Yes. Before, I was totally uncomfortable with people.
Really?
You know, totally. And then I had to, as I said, interview people and go and make home visits, and it just changed. It just changed dramatically.
Oh, you did home visits. That's incredible. Well, that's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So I could see how desperate so many of these applicants were, because, you know, they're a young woman in her early 20s, and she was married and has a couple of children, and all of a sudden she doesn't have a husband, she doesn't have any income. I mean, she's without the state's assistance and the aid to families that would depend on children, that was the name of the program. You know, she'd be homeless, you know. So I guess the fact that I could relate to what they were going through, it took the pressure off me to get out of myself and say, wait, I'm not the one. I'm not the one here who doesn't have any income. I'm not the one whose husband left them and has to raise a couple of children. So you're right. When you put yourself out there and you meet people and you realize that other people, and what I say to people now is 99% of us have a problem. I use a term that I can't say on the air right now, but, you know, so many people have dysfunctions in one area of their life or another. And the important thing is for us to become aware of those, so that we can do something about it, or we can work around it.
Right. It's like, how do you soften those edges? Everyone's going to have something, and that's okay. And it's what's beautiful about that too is, like, it's okay to not be perfect. You know, there's actually one of the things that really has inspired me in terms of thinking about resilience is an old myth, and I can't remember the origin of it, but this is how it goes. There's an old woman who lives at the center of the earth. She lives in an earthen hut. And in that hut, her activity is weaving a tapestry. And while she's weaving the tapestry, she also has a fire there, a hearth, where there is a soup on a pot. And a dog also lives in this hut with her. Every now and then she has to walk away from her tapestry and go stir the soup. While she's walking away, the dog comes and takes a thread from the tapestry and pulls it away and unravels it. And so when she goes back, she has to redo the work that she's done. And this myth, for me, the story really, the image of it and everything was so profound for me. And what it enabled for me, or constantly enables for me, is accepting that. Resilience for me is accepting what is. Okay, this is the way it is. The story does not include her yelling at the dog or kicking the dog out or anything like this. There's a profound acceptance there that the work that we do is reweaving, and our work isn't finished, whether we talk about the environment, whether we talk about our own mental health issues, whether we talk about whatever we're doing here in this city, whatever we're doing in the world. All of this is this constant, beautiful tapestry that we're making that is unraveling and being raveled, you know, or being woven back. And in that, I often think about my hands. I think about other people's hands. I think about what we do in the best of times and the worst of times with our actual hands, you know. And the unraveling, we can't help. It's going to be there. It's going to happen. So you definitely want to have some level of tapestry there, a significant level of it. And then when you think about community and you think about, you know, how we all work together after, say, a hurricane or things like this, what it brings out. And my big question is, how do we sustain that? How do we keep, you know, weaving this tapestry together? And I think Sarasota is pretty unique in the way that you have a huge volunteer community where people meet in the place of where they can benefit other people. And I'm not interested in rose-colored glasses either. I will say that. It's not a that kind of of an investigation. The show itself is basically an investigation. And so it's, you know, when I tell the story of that myth, it's not about, you know, we're all weaving this tapestry and it's all beautiful and it's all perfect. No, things unravel. That is the fact of the way the physics of our world exists. But I think humans have a beautiful place. If we think about Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he was a great weaver, you know, not just of stories, but also of weaving community together in a very special way. I mean, he inspired Thich Nhat Hanh, who was Vietnamese, in the midst of, you know, what was happening, which, of course, for the Vietnamese, it was the American War. For us, it was the war in Vietnam. But he came from Vietnam, inspired by Martin Luther King Jr., to believe that there's something good in America, and of course was devastated by his death. But he really was able to bring people and weave people together. And every one of us, I mean, I think that's the title of the show, The Best of Us, is really, in a way, we could just call it The Best in Us. And, you know, my hope for the show is, you know, it's about being human in Sarasota. It's about this hyper-local. But I'm hoping that eventually other people will come forward and want to tell the same kind of, do the same kind of format for their hyper-local community, whether it be on WSLR or wherever else. But yeah, I'm really like just so happy to be here on the show with you today, not only on your birthday, but of course, happy birthday. But on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday too.
Well, thank you, Bethany. I appreciate that. You did a good job of explaining yourself, the show, what's going to transpire in the show, where everything is coming from, and your hopes. So it's a beautiful thing, Bethany. We're so happy you're going to be here. Another member to the programming team, the volunteers who are here because they love it. And I met Bethany when I was volunteering for the station at the WSLR table at the Sarasota Farmers Market. We've been so fortunate over the years, probably 15 years or so, that we get a free table. A nonprofit gets a free table once a month, and we're there the first Saturday of every month. And I love volunteering, Bethany, because I get to meet people from all over. And I've probably have had two or three guests from just over the last 6 months, just from meeting people when I volunteer at the table. And I had gone down there. I wasn't even scheduled to be a volunteer that day, but I was walking by and I joined you and Sheila Jane. And that's where I got to meet you. And so it's just another example of people meeting people through community and being involved in the community. And we love it. I've been on the air now for close to 19 years. I can't believe it. And I've been sitting here on a few Martin Luther King birthdays and my birthday over that 19-year period. And so let me mention to the audience that they're listening to their own community radio station right here in Sarasota, WSLR, LP 96.5 FM, and in Bradenton, WBPV, LP 100.1 FM. And I'd like to mention that this is our 20th year. We opened the doors and went on the air in August of 2005. So we're looking at this whole year as being a 20th anniversary. And for two decades, your support has made everything we do possible. Now we want to hear from you. Take a moment to fill out the 2025 listener survey and help shape the future of WSLR. It's a quick and easy. Just visit WSLR.org and click the banner on the homepage. Thank you for an incredible 20 years. And what I'd like to do is play another song by U2, and it's actually titled MLK. on Martin Luther King's birthday. So here it comes. With ML King, imagine an Irish group in the 80s writing two songs that are one specifically about Martin Luther King and another one referencing his assassination on April 4th in 1968. But you can tell Bono is an enlightened individual. He's done so much work around the environment and human rights. So you could see way back when, in the 80s, he was inspired by Martin Luther King. So Bethany, I know you had done some work out in Los Angeles around climate, and there was a program out there. Could you talk a little bit about that and what's happening right now?
Yeah, definitely. So at the time that I was there, I was helping to develop an organization called Climate Resolve. And we were working with a scientist, an IPCC scientist, who had been brought into doing work on modeling climate change for the next 50 years into a hyper-local Los Angeles. So using all of those models to start looking at what's happening in that time horizon of 30 to 50 years for basically for city planning purposes, and been brought in by the mayor of Los Angeles at the time. So we were helping people to at the city level to communicate this, to figure out the language around it, to understand that this wasn't a story that we wanted to hide. We wanted to tell the story, but people at the city level really wanted to understand what the language was that they could deliver. So we brought in, fortunately, we were fortunate enough to get the Red Cross to come in and leadership in the community, such as doctors, and to really show that it was also a public health issue. you know, seeing what's going on in Los Angeles now has really hit me a little bit hard, because not because I only, you know, I know people there, but also because it was in 2012 that I was sitting in a meeting with politicians, with this scientist and a few others that we were working with, and laying out the science behind climate change and climate crisis and what we could see could be happening in Los Angeles within the next 30 to 50 years, thoughts on how to prepare. And this particular one at that time was about heat. At some point, one of the senators that was in the meeting, and these were senators that were interested in being there, he had a what I would call like a climate epiphany and said, wow, this, what you're describing, and I think he was hoping for them to say, no, that's not what we're talking about. But he said, what you're describing looks like disaster at biblical proportions. And the whole room was silent, because many people who were there already understood. And, you know, we just, people need education and what this actually means. And it's a huge thing. It's a hyper object. That's what they call climate change, a hyper object. And it's slowly becoming a hyper local object. Not so slow, actually. But now I saw the other day a headline of someone describing it, saying this is a disaster of biblical proportions. And it just resonated for me and made me think back on that time. And I know there are other people like Rafe Pomerantz, who had been working as a lobbyist, you know, from the 70s in Washington, D.C. about this. And I'm certainly not alone in being someone who's trying to communicate with politicians and build public support and understanding around what these issues are that we're moving into. And, you know, whenever we look at any of the environmental issues and or disaster issues, the main thing we can look at again, or at least that makes me feel better, or makes me feel hopeful in any way, is that there are so many people working on this issue, and we can just join that chorus. There's not as much written about these people who are dedicating their whole lives, even if you think about the manatee issues here, or the habitat issues here. There are people all throughout Florida devoting their whole life's work to being in relationship with this problem, and it can seem overwhelming. You know, I'm very rarely able to actually dip into the depth of a feeling around this, partly because it's so big, but certainly even seeing the fires in LA, I feel tender about it, and I also feel very guarded of my feelings. You know, it's a difficult feeling to dip into. And, you know, we have so many things like that happening, that this is also why, for me, resilience is so important in developing that and developing community. You know, the only way to get through this is to go through it, and to go through it with other people. Whatever happens, whatever people actually decide they want to do or not do about some of these larger issues, but certainly on a local level, what we can do is do our best to adapt and get through it together.
Well, the resilience—it's that says it all, because people, you know, with the hurricanes here and people losing their homes, and you know, it's without resilience, people cannot come back. And it's the community aspect. It's so that people bond together during the, when a tragedy happens, a disaster happens, and that's, it just goes to show you that that's the way people want to be anyway. You know, whenever there's a disaster, and you say, oh, Chicago strong, or Boston strong, or LA strong, the bottom line is, we're all strong when people need us, because we rise above the, it's, you know, the same thing, the inhibitions or the whatever it might be, the insecurities that won't allow us to go talk to our neighbor because they look a little different than us. You know, that's it. And but then when something happens, you know, when it's a disaster and it's, people preparing for a hurricane, everybody's knocking on everyone's door. Is there anything I can do? Or how can I help? So it that's the way people really are.
I mean, I've had people tell me that some of the crises that they've experienced in their lives, that were someone who was in New York City during Hurricane Sandy, and the way they experienced community coming together, the way they became a community member in that moment, is one of the deepest, most meaningful moments of their life. That doesn't mean we want more of disaster, but for me, that makes me wonder, okay, how am I contributing to the lapse that happens after disaster? How can we look at having those meaningful moments that we don't have to wait for that, you know, in a way? And I know there, Richard Powers, a novelist, has talked about this a little bit, is like the conversations we need now are conversations that are meaningful. You know, we need those conversations that are going to take us a little deeper into our life experience. And that's going to nourish us, hopefully. You know, I seek that out, but I can be addicted to my phone. I don't talk to my neighbors every day. I sometimes avoid my neighbors because I just don't have capacity to talk to them. So I'm, you know, a lot of things with this show and with resilience is aspirational. I'm still learning, and I'm going to be learning from all the people who come on the show. I'm learning, you know, just even in my conversation with you and what this brings up in conversation with other people. And, you know, my life trajectory is really learning about that. I keep wondering, okay, so should I be doing like a block party? Like, how am I going to get close to my neighbors? How am I going to have it so when something happens that disrupts my small neighborhood, how can I prevent that person from completely falling apart and getting just incredibly angry and screaming? You know, so many people will just get super, super angry. And it's not like you know, with PTSD, I certainly had my experience with, like, you know, feeling out of control, you know, but I feel like, you know, sometimes we forget that other people are human. Other people online are human. Other people that we're calling on the phone are human. Other people in other cars are human. And everybody's doing their best to fend off, you know, chaos.
No, that's the best way to put it. Everyone is human, you know. Everyone's is embarrassed by some of the things they say. And our things can be taken out of context and say, well, did I really say that? Well, I'm sorry. But, you know, people are human. You know,
and we're animals.
Well, I'd like to play one more video here. It's not music. It's Martin Luther King. And the title of this YouTube video is My Dream Has Turned Into a Nightmare. So let me play that, and Bethany and I will be back after this to wrap up the show.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
I must confess that that dream that I had that day has at many points turned into a nightmare. Now, I'm not one to lose hope. I keep on hoping. I still have faith in the future. But I've had to analyze many things over the last few years, and I would say over the last few months. I've gone through a lot of soul-searching and agonizing moments. And I've come to see that we have many more difficult days ahead, and some of the old optimism was a little superficial, and now it must be tempered with a solid realism. And I think the realistic fact is that we still have a long, long way to go, and that we are involved in a war on Asian soil, which, if not checked and stopped, can poison the very soul of our nation. I'm not going to say that all of our problems will be solved if the war in Vietnam is ended, but I do say that the war makes it infinitely more difficult to deal with these problems. When a nation becomes obsessed with the guns of war, it loses its social perspective, and programs of social uplift suffer. This is just a fact of history, so that we do face many more difficulties as a result of the war. It's much more difficult to really arouse a conscience during a time of war. That is something about a war like this that makes people insensitive. It dulls the conscience. It strengthens the forces of reaction, and it brings into being bitterness and hatred and violence. I think the biggest problem now is that we got our gains over the last 12 years at bargain rate, so to speak. It didn't cost the nation anything. In fact, it helped the economic side of the nation to integrate lunch counters and public accommodations. It didn't cost the nation anything to get the right to vote established. And now we are confronting issues that cannot be solved without costing the nation billions of dollars. Now, I think this is where we're getting our greatest resistance. They may put it on many other things, but we can't get rid of slums and poverty without it costing the nation something. I feel that nonviolence is really the only way that we can follow, because violence is just so self-defeating. A riot ends up creating many more problems for the Negro community than it solves. You can, through violence, burn down a building, but you can't establish justice. You can murder a murderer, but you can't murder through violence. You can murder a hater, but you can't murder hate. And what we are trying to get rid of is hate and injustice and all of these other things that continue the long night of man's inhumanity to man.
When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Martin Luther King, happy birthday. Of course, 60 years ago, you made it clear how you felt about what was going on in Vietnam and how the United States was the biggest purveyor of violence in the world, and how there was a relationship between what was happening in Vietnam and why people in the United States were not getting enough food to eat, why racial injustice existed. And, you know, unfortunately, 60 years later, things haven't changed all that much, especially when you look at the military-industrial complex, which Martin Luther King condemned in relationship to how much money was being spent for weapons sent all around the world. When there are people who are poor here, who are homeless. But I guess a lot of people are still working on it, just like Bethany had mentioned. I'd like to mention that you can celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in spoken word and song with Sarasota's West Coast Black Theater Troupe Sunday, January 19th at the Sarasota Opera House. West Coast performers and guest artists perform gospel, soul, and popular songs of the civil rights era in a soul-stirring production that honors the life and legacy of Dr. King. This annual show is a unique experience every year. Tickets at westcoasttheater.org, westcoasttheater.org. So, Bethany, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, so why don't you wrap up whatever you'd like to say relating to your show or anything else for the next 3 or 4 minutes.
Well, just a reminder that the show will be February 2nd at 10 a.m. That's a Sunday. And I wanted to read a poem by Lucille Clifton And this is a poem that makes me think of Dr. King, makes me think of, has really gotten me through since COVID. And it's in honor of your birthday and Dr. King's birthday. Lucille Clifton's poem is called Birthday. Today we are possible. The morning, green and laundry sweet, opens itself and we enter, blind and mewling. Everything waits for us. The snow kingdom sparkling and silent in its glacial cap. The cane fields shining and sweet in the sun-drenched south. As the day arrives, with all its clumsy blessings, what we will become waits in us like an ache. That's Birthday by Lucille Clifton.
Beautiful, beautiful. I'm just going to play a minute or two of a song I would like to end the show with, and then we'll come back and say goodbye. But it's a group. It's someone I just discovered a short time ago. And the title of the song is Love is the Only Thing.
It heals me when I'm broken, brings me in from the cold. And in my darkest moments, it illuminates my soul. There is no greater power, no higher place to be. And if I say the words out louder, will they cover you and me?
Love is the Only Thing, Martin Luther King, Los Frequencies, and you've been listening to the Peace and Justice Report. Bethany, I'd like to say goodbye and let the audience know one more time when your first show is going to be on.
Thank you so much for having me on, Bob. And the first show is going to be Sunday, February 2nd at 10 a.m. The show is, again, called The Best of Us, Being Human in Sarasota.
And next week, Tom Walker will be back with his version of the Peace and Justice Report. And I know on Monday there's going to be I don't have the details in front of me, but from the MLK parade that will take place, we've been have a public service announcement that's been talking about it, so stay tuned. But it's this next Monday, the day that Martin Luther King's birthday